Thank you. willen hebben. En ik kom hollowen naar mijn kop op mijn pillow. Ik hollow, ik hollow, ik hollow, ik hollow, ik hollow. En hier wel lekker witte wijn, hollow, hier voor een nieuwe home away. Allahoy, Hawaiian cowboy. San Francisco by the Golden Gate. Aloha like a Hawaiian cowboy.
Cowboy by OK Bright. That was a Hawaiian cowboy, and I just lost who it was by. I'll look it up again. And then before that was a record that Mark bought for me at the thrift store yesterday. It's called A Live Sound, Welcome to My World by Dave and Bonnie Harry. And a song was called She Taught Me to Yodel. And it doesn't have all those skips in it. He also bought a Fisher-Price record player, so that's the record player. I have to stack quarters on the needle and a little plastic molded bunny rabbit, and you have to have the exact right proportion of quarters and bunny rabbits on the needle to make it not skip. And I didn't get it right. Both Mark and Dove can get it right, but I had a hard time. So it was skipping a lot, but believe it or not, a lot of that was not skipping. That was yodeling, repetition happening. So welcome to Radio Free Erica, the final broadcast from Basin, Montana. Let's see, on the thermometer in the studio, it says it's almost 80 degrees, but it feels hotter than that. It's been really hot. We got here, it was kind of cool. We were wearing sweaters all day, every day, and all of a sudden it's like summertime, and it's been hot and dry and gorgeous. And it's something that I'll miss, is that at night it really cools down, and the morning really cools down, and you can sort of smell the bricks and like the pine, and I don't know, from the heat from the day before. I'm gonna miss all those scents. I know we're going back to New York, where there will be new scents, new summer scents to replace the pine needle scents and the hot brick. It'll be replaced with hot garbage and dog urine. But it's pretty amazing sensual experience here, both from just like the air on your skin, like that really hot and dry, and the smells and the sounds too. So today, Briar Herchek from The High Note up the street is going to come down around 1, and she's going to talk about running. The only breakfast place in town. There's one other place that serves food in town. It's called the Leaning Tower of Pizza. And as I'm sure you can guess, they make pizza. It's a dinner place, and they have a little bar in there too. But Breyer has like a cafe, where she does a really amazing breakfast, 4 days a week, 4 mornings a week. And then she also sometimes hosts jazz music there in the evenings and performances. And it's kind of an amazing space. And so I wanted her to talk about it. She does a lot of her own cooking and baking. And since we are at 5,300 feet, it's just where high altitude starts to kick in terms of baking and sort of changing boiling temperatures, those sorts of things. So I wanted to ask her about that. And I think she originally comes from Seattle, so I wanted to talk to her about that move and just living in Basin. She's part of the network of amazing women here that are making art and music and poetry. And then as well as Breyer, I've asked Liz and Ryan, and I don't know their last names. It's kind of that kind of town where I don't know their last names. But Liz and Ryan are, they're from Minnesota, and they bought a building a couple doors down from the refuge here. Has no electricity or heat. I don't think they live in it, but they run like a small like rummage sail out of it sometimes. And they have great stories. And when we've been out thrifting and garage sailing, we've run into them. And clearly they're very passionate about collecting stuff. So I wanted to ask them to come. I know Liz said she could come. Ryan said he wasn't sure. So it's just to talk about the culture of that here in Montana. I used to do vintage clothes buying for a shop when I was in college in the early 90s in San Luis Obispo. So I would go to thrift stores and garage sales and shop for the store. And it was a really, I loved doing it. And I guess if it's something that you like to do, it's something you always do, like just antique stores or whatever. But I've been so amazed in Montana with that culture here, because it seems somehow like it's 30 years behind, at least in California. And well, New York, it's just like it's a whole other thing. You can't even really do it there. Everything's been so overshopped. But we went into a thrift store in Butte the other day. Well, it wasn't a thrift store, it was an antique store. And it was the most amazing collection of vintage clothing I've ever seen. And we've done a lot of vintage clothes shopping. That's what I spent a good portion of graduate school doing, undergraduate in between. And in Chicago and California and others, Georgia's, that amazing store in Chicago was probably the closest thing I've seen to it before, where he had this special room. If you sat with him for a while and had coffee and chatted and up for a while, he'd take you into the special room. Well, this store in Butte was like, it blew the special room out of the water, at least my memory of it. Everything was so intact. And there were just racks of blouses from the 20s that had never been worn. And I don't know if it had come from some department store locally that it had gone out of business or... But it was like something out of a vintage shopper's dream. Unfortunately, the prices were not. But, it was just interesting. The woman in the shop was not the owner, but she was talking to me about the climate, sort of keeping these things intact. And she's talking to me about sort of the political history of Butte and how perhaps people held on to things sort of more tightly and longer because of just the history of strife, labor strife, and the waves of having and not having and struggle. And so maybe these things are coming to those kinds of stores later in a place like that. It was interesting. And I guess I love exploring the history of a place that way through sort of the thrift shops and the antique shops, and talking to one woman in one of the antique shops about how she, that there is a dump that was closed in the early 40s, and that it's one of her favorite places to go and to just dig and find all sorts of amazing things. And again, I guess because of the climate, things are really intact. But anyhow, Liz has more experience with this, so hopefully she'll come and tell some of her stories of doing those exact same things. So those are our two guests today. And this being Basin, and not really having anybody's phone number, I did confirm with Briar, she's coming at 1, but Liz, hopefully she'll still be able to come. Talking about that history of the strife and the labor situation in Butte, Mark's been reading this book called The Wobblies. Since we've been here, it's a graphic history of the industrial workers of the world, edited by Paul Buell and Nicole Schulman. And he's been telling me some great, amazing stories about the mining history in this area of Montana. And somehow it's taken the beauty away from copper. When we were in Butte, we saw this amazing hotel that had all sorts of copper leafing and copper stairway embellishments, and it was amazing. But also the first thing that came to my mind were some of these stories that Mark had told me. And I'm just going to look in here. I didn't pull the exact page of these out. Do it from the other direction. So he was telling me about the history of labor and just sort of this period of time, like, where the mining companies would hire literally thugs to beat up anybody who was trying to organize, and people coming from labor organizations outside of Montana to help people organize, and that they would be very publicly sort of pulled out of bed and dragged around town and hung, and all sorts of like amazing stories that somehow being in the actual place, like, it makes it so much more potent and real. And sort of traveling by the huge pit in Butte that is now full of toxic water, it keeps filling with water that runs down through the old mine, so then it's full of arsenic and copper and all sorts of heavy metals. And it's such a huge, you know, I'll put a picture of it up on the website. It's such a huge it's such a huge part of the landscape, and it's so big that the EPA has decided, rather than trying to clean the whole thing up, that they'll just continually try to manage it. Hi, Liz. Come on back. Hi, Liz. Come on in. Turn this on for you. There's water over here for you. Liz, I realized I don't know your last name.
Kelly.
Kelly. Like, it's that kind of town where everybody's just their first name.
Right.
Thanks for coming. And this is on, and this is on.
Okay.
And just talking a little bit about that, you have the building a couple doors down,
mm-hmm.
and that you guys sometimes operate like a rummage sale out of.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And just our little bit of garage selling and stuff. We've seen Ryan around, and then hearing you guys at breakfast the other morning telling your stories, I was so excited to have you come and talk about it. I used to do vintage shopping when I was in college for a little store in a town, and
uh-huh.
I think it's once you start, it's like something you do forever.
You get sucked into the vortex.
Yeah. I was curious or excited to have you come and talk about, I don't know, just some, yeah, what, well, if it was something you guys did before you came here or if it was something you started mm-hmm. here and just some mm-hmm. of your stories.
Right. Well, I guess I've always been thrifty, thrifty shopper since I was a kid, you mm-hmm. know. I guess maybe it started when I was like in junior high and my parents would give me money for school clothes. And I realized I could get a lot more if I went to Ragstock and Savers, you know, those stores back in the Midwest. But yeah, and then I've also always been into antiques and just quality handmade things. And I especially like things with a history. It seems like, you know, modern new products of any kind just lack quality and also character. So it's a way to, I guess, find, you know, what you're looking for, I guess, a lot less, but then also you're not being quite as much of a modern consumer by supporting the whole recycling industry. And I guess I do that too. I mean, I'll find things and then I will later get rid of them again. And sometimes I'm able to resell things for actually more than what I paid for them. But yeah, we've always liked thrift stores, and also the local dump is actually a good place to find a lot of, you know, building materials and things like that. We've used a lot of recycled salvaged wood and doors and windows and things like that from the dump too, so.
Oh, great.
Yeah, yeah.
Just the one right up the street here.
Well, that dump isn't really, it used to be open to like scavenging, and when it was, I found an antique cedar chest there, like this big blanket chest.
Oh my goodness.
All cedar, yeah. It's totally amazing. But now that one's closed to salvaging, so the Boulder dump is the one that you can go to to find stuff. And our friend Dave found bicycles there for his whole family.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, totally, totally operational. You know, mountain bikes, like a, you know, 10-year-old specialized was one of them. Pretty good bikes, actually, so. So that's, you know, a way to get things for free, I guess, but it's like, I think it's sort of a modern day phenomenon, you know. I bet probably 50 and more years ago, it wasn't even an option. Like, mm-hmm. when you bought something, you bought it new, and that was what you had, like, for your whole life. And now we just live in such a throwaway society that you can find everything that you need. You know, and quality stuff. Yeah. I actually just went to a thrift store yesterday.
Oh, you did?
And I wasn't even thinking about this at the time. But
did you find anything good?
Well, just a few things. I guess I found one thing that was really cool is a hand-woven linen tapestry.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that also has hand embroidery on it, which is probably either from India or Nepal or something like that. But I could tell that the linen was all hand woven. I mean, you could see the ends and everything
right.
where it was done, and the tiniest little threads. And that was like $2. So
yeah.
It's kind of amazing.
Which one did you go to?
The Good Samaritan in Helena.
I had the most amazing experience there like a week ago.
Oh, really?
Like in their linen section, I found this amazing hand-quilted tablecloth, and mm-hmm. for like $4.50, I think that was the most expensive thing I bought.
Right.
And
yeah.
like a baby bib that was hand-embroidered, and just, yeah, just, I was saying before you came, like, it seems somehow that what's happened, or like shopping like that, like I've never seen thrifting quite like that. Once before in Wisconsin, we stopped someplace and it was like a dream.
Mm-hmm.
Like there was just like all this amazing china and like crazy things that usually you find a piece of, and there were full sets. And
mm-hmm.
but I feel like here somehow it's like 30 years behind,
mm-hmm.
like California or wherever I've been right. before, because
exactly.
it's been so picked over.
Right, right. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, you know, because Montana was, you know, kind of a gold rush era, you know, boom area, I guess, you know, a lot of it got abandoned. So, you know, like especially Butte, you know,
right.
a lot of that. I mean, half of those old buildings downtown, at least half of them are abandoned now and full of old stuff, you know. So,
yeah.
So that's kind of why, I think, you know. And plus the population here is so low. The whole state is like, you know, 900,000 or something. Yeah, so there's not as many people to pick through. But, yeah, it's pretty amazing. That is a good thrift store.
Yeah.
They just had a half price even.
Like
the last week of every month they do 50% off of the entire store, which it's cheap to begin with.
Oh,
so
my
then
goodness.
It's like they practically give it away.
So they're clearing it out to
mm-hmm.
then fill it up again.
Right, right.
Well,
mm-hmm.
I was in a shop in Butte a couple of days ago. It's an antique shop, but she had a lot of vintage clothing. Do you know? I think it's on Park, one of the corners there. And she has just a ton of vintage clothing. I didn't see any other stores with vintage
okay,
clothing.
Okay, I think I know which one you're talking about.
But her prices are really high. Like
mm-hmm,
somehow
mm-hmm.
they seem sort of incongruous with everything else in
right.
the town. Like
mm-hmm.
they seem like New York City prices.
Yes.
And
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was just so impressed with how intact everything was, the clothing and.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. Yeah, usually those vintage sort of boutiques can command a higher price because they only select like the best of the
mm-hmm.
best vintage things. I've tried to sell. I mean, I guess I've sold a few things to those kind of stores, but you know, I don't always find the, you know, things that are in the best condition. So I don't know how people do that actually, probably raiding their grandma's attics or whatever. But.
Well, and do you know like who their clientele is?
You know, I don't. I wonder if it's, you know, maybe just people traveling through
yeah.
from out of state, because it doesn't seem like too many Butte people would pay those kind of prices.
No, we wouldn't even pay the prices.
Right.
So
yeah.
I was just curious. It was kind of a big surprise
mm-hmm.
Looking at the price tags. And so I was curious if they're selling like on the internet, or if, I guess the woman who owned the store was away at a show, like some sort of doll show. So maybe that's, I don't know. It was interesting that they had tons. They had just beautiful old fabrics and.
Mhm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it also seemed, in Butte, going from one of those antique stores and thrift stores to another, like everybody was talking about the same woman's birthday party. She must have had an antique store as well. Like it seemed like a real community.
Uh-huh.
Like. We've been in three, and in the third one, they're talking about this woman's birthday party and her, how she over-celebrated, you know, like we knew her whole story.
Oh, that's
funny. By the time we got to the third one, it was really funny. I was just wondering if you feel like you run into the same people at the dump or the different places, and if you feel like there's a community.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think that's true pretty much anywhere in Montana. I mean, Butte, especially, I guess, has the appearance of an urban area because of all the buildings, but you know, now the population is so much lower than it once was that there isn't even a use for all those buildings. In fact, Butte is a place that you can actually thrift old buildings. The city started this thing a couple of years ago where they'll accept bids on basically condemned old buildings. And our friend Pete looked into it last summer and found this three-story brick apartment building that was $1,000.
Wow.
But he opted against it, I guess, because of all the work involved. But, you know, you can actually find, you know, really inexpensive real estate in Butte, which is unlike the entire rest of the state. You know, so, but, you know, here in Basin, I guess everybody knows everybody's story. You know, it's kind of... you know, when Ryan and I moved out here, we kind of liked the idea of remaining anonymous, sort of, you know, because we grew up in a small town in Minnesota. And, you know, it didn't last very long. Everybody figured it out what we were doing. But, yeah, I like that feel, though. Here it's an unpretentious kind of feel, so it's good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And how long have you guys been here in Montana?
8 years.
8 years.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine you guys also, because you guys are sort of that demographic, it seems like, that leave Montana, like younger people. It seems like I hear a lot about people saying, oh, but the younger people always leave. And,
mm-hmm.
and so I imagine you guys being younger people coming in, like that's unusual also.
Well, in some areas it is. I guess a lot of people don't move here to Basin. But, you know, Bozeman and Missoula, places like that, a lot of people move to.
Right.
But, yeah, I think it's kind of like that anywhere. You know, if you grow up in a place, you just don't really appreciate it as much, you know, as, you know, for us, we came from, you know, farm country in central Minnesota, so it was an exciting new life to move out into the mountains, even though it's very rural, but that was kind of what we decided we wanted to do.
Uh-huh. Well, and it seems like all of the women sort of connected to the residency, like they all moved out here in their 20s or,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
And so it's the next generation of that.
Yeah.
Sort of cultivating.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And It's you see a lot of people don't move to Basin, but like there is such a strong community here and such a
mm-hmm.
sort of committed group of people here that
mm-hmm.
It makes sense as an attractive place.
Right.
Like, mm-hmm. Even though there are a few people, there are a few amazing people.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of a high concentration of interesting people in a small town area.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But this area is getting more popular, actually, with all the... Because basically the Deer Lodge National Forest is, I think it's like twice the size of Yellowstone Park, and that's what we're basically smack dab in the middle of. And so a lot of people are interested in this area for, you know, recreational use, but like not in a cool way, more like ATVs that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what are some of like the most exciting things you've found surfing or going to the dump chest and...
That was a big one, uh-huh. the chest, yeah. I guess I've found a lot of old quilts and things like that and, you know, hand-knit items. And I do needle work. I sew and I knit. So I guess I have a heightened appreciation for that sort of thing. And, you know, it just sort of amazes me that, like, people get rid of that stuff. Like,
yeah.
their grandma or somebody made that and they just... give it away. I just can't imagine, but I found some interesting, like one quilt has 1940 embroidered on the side of it, and it's made out of all old clothes, like I assume from the Depression era, you
yeah.
know, so it just has a lot of history. And I guess other things I've found, you know, mission style furniture, oak furniture for my house, wool rugs, like Persian rugs, which I love. And you know, I'm kind of like a fabric snob now anymore. I find cashmere all the time at thrift stores. And I thought about this last night, so I would like have some things in my mind to remember. And I figured I found at least 100 cashmere sweaters.
Oh my goodness.
Like just in the last couple years at thrift stores. But I'm pretty dedicated. I mean, I usually go once a week to at least one thrift store. So, but yeah, it's, you know, it's pretty amazing what people get rid of. So, and then, you know, a lot of those cashmere things, sweaters or whatever that I don't use, or if they're too tattered, I'll make them into something else, you know, so it's part of that whole recycling process. But yeah, I mean, I guess just everything, almost everything that I own is thrifted in some way, you know, from a thrift store, rummage sale, or what, Badump or whatever, you know, like, you know, all my kitchen stuff, most of my furniture, all my clothes, except for I do buy new socks and underwear. I don't recycle those. Yeah, almost everything. And I feel pretty spoiled. Like, I mean, I get to do whatever I want, you know. I'm not strapped in any way financially. And I think that's part of the reason is because, you know, because I'm thrifty and it's easy to be thrifty. So I think it also gives you a lot of more personal freedom, you know. But.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting because you're talking about the quality of stuff, and I feel like now if you want something that has been handmade or it's, so it costs so much money. Like, you can find it, but it costs so much money.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you buy something that's 50 years old or whatever, then it has that same sort of integrity about it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We were actually in a high-priced vintage store, and then we walked two doors down to, I think it was the St. Vincent de Paul in the high-priced vintage store, Mark tried on this really nice old Pendleton, and it was $60-something. And mm-hmm. we're like, oh, well, I don't know, maybe one. We'll see what the rest of the day is. And then we walked down mm-hmm. to the St. Vincent de Paul, and there was one for $1.50.
Mm-hmm.
Like, really similar. Not quite as nice, but, like, almost the exact same thing.
Right. Yeah. Isn't that amazing? Yeah, for sure. It's a good feeling to get good deals like that. Mm-hmm. And Pendletons, I mean, as long as they're in good shape, they really hold their value, so.
Yeah, and they last a really long time.
Yeah, the quality is amazing. I actually, funny thing, I make those bird things. Have you seen those? They're like, I have them at Briar's.
Oh, those, you made those. Those are beautiful.
Yeah, thanks. at this one point, see, I've always loved Pendleton, like their blankets and clothes, everything. But I have all these old Pendleton shirts, you know, that weren't really wearable anymore. They were shrunken or had holes in them or whatever. So I made some bird things just out of Pendleton.
You should describe what the bird things are.
Okay, sorry. They're they're like these, well, I call them folk art bird things. They're I make them out of recycled wool, basically vintage wool that I've found at thrift stores. They're little stuffed birds that are strung up on a string with usually glass and wood beads. With like a little bell on the bottom and then a brass, an old antique brass curtain ring on the top, so you can hang them like in a doorway or window or whatever. I have them all over my house actually. But anyway, I made one just for Pendleton out of Pendleton shirts, and I even put, they have these little triangular wings sewn onto them. I put a little Pendleton tag for a wing, and then I had a friend of mine was going out to Oregon, so I had him bring it to Pendleton factory to like give them as a gift. And I guess he said that whoever he talked to was like, oh, thanks, you know, but like, I don't know if he brought it to the right person or what, but they probably, and I sent this card with him too to like thank them for like continuing to make a quality product, you know what I mean? Because still, even today, Pendleton is a good quality product. So I just wanted to show my appreciation. I guess, but they probably thought I was a nutcase. I don't know. That was funny.
That's great. I wonder if they have a whole collection of things like that, you know, like quilts or whatever things that I bet they must.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They added that all of my older relatives, like everybody's very committed to Pendleton. Like it's like that kind of a brand.
Right.
Because it's that kind of a product, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Many generations are still doing the Pendleton thing. Yeah.
So it's kind of a, my language skills are out the window for a minute now. So it's a transition, but would you mind talking about working at the mine and what that?
Sure.
It sounds like you're a miner saying it that way. So you can describe what you do.
Well, I just run the office of the Mary Widow Health Mine here in Basin, which is a radon mine, which I guess it opened in 1952. It used to be a gold and silver mine, but then they discovered it has uranium ore in the granite. And as uranium breaks down, it puts off radon gas. It's just one of the daughters of uranium as it breaks down. And, you know, radon gas, it's the same thing that, you know, the EPA warns about in your basement, but in low doses, it's actually a stimuli for the immune system. So it's kind of just like anything else, you know, it's all in the dose. Too much of anything is going to be harmful, so radon's no exception, but it helps most people to get off of their pharmaceutical medications and, you know, the extent of, you know, help that people get really varies, you know, but it's definitely a high percentage of people that feel positive results, and also dogs, you know, crippled old dogs will experience pain relief and, you know, more of an ease and mobility because of the, I guess, you know, because everything kind of goes back to your immune system. So by stimulating that and regulating your hormones, you can kind of, you know, control pain and, you know, different things that come with aging, I guess. So, and that's, you know, a really unique thing that we have here. There's only a few radon spas in the whole world. There's some in Austria and Russia. But, you know, here in the United States, there's just a few right in this area because right here on the eastern slope of the Continental Divide, it's considered like the Boulder Batholith, which is a heavy concentration of granite. So there's just more uranium here than in other parts of the state or whatever. Like you couldn't just take any old mine shaft and turn it into a health mine. You know, it has to have just the right amount, like not too much and not too little.
Right.
So, and the Mary Widow mine has 1,300 picocuries per liter, if anyone knows what that is. But anyhow, yeah, we get people from all over the world, all over the country and all over the world. And a lot of the same people come back every year to do the treatments again. Most people stay for like, you know, 10 or 11 days and do 1 hour treatments every day, usually three times a day. So it's, you know, kind of an extended time. So we get to know a lot of the people better. And yeah, it's really amazing to have seen, you know, firsthand how it helps people. And it, you know, that was just such an obscure idea to me. Like, I studied naturopathic medicine for a couple of years back in Minnesota, but I had never heard of that as a therapy, you know, using radon. Mm-hmm. You know, that was always so talked against everywhere. But after experiencing it, I realized, you know, it really is just like anything else. And it's, you know, I'm not afraid, you know, to be near it when the dose is low. And of course, I'm not in the mine all the time. I have an office outside of it. So.
Yeah, I was wondering, for you, being there however many days a week or whatever, how, if they've talked about that with you or you've...
Right. Well, you know, I don't spend a great deal of time in there each day. I usually go in there in the morning for about 10 minutes or so. And, you know, that's it leaves your system right away, basically. Whatever radon you inhale, it doesn't attach to any chemical bond in the body. So it basically gets exhaled after a certain amount of time, leaves your body. So I guess I haven't really, it hasn't been a concern. I guess if I was there for, many, many years, I might worry a little bit about my exposure to it. But at this point, I'm not concerned about it. And then I drink the spring water out of there all the time, which doesn't concern me either. It has small amounts of radon in the water, but, any spring water in this area is going to have radon in it if it flows through granite.
Right.
I would rather drink spring water fresh out of the mountains than anything from a bottle from a grocery store, so that's not really a concern for me, but, it really has helped people to basically heal themselves, It's your own body healing yourself, but it just provides the stimuli. So that's been really an interesting aspect of my life in Basin. And I guess it was sort of random because I didn't move here for that job. It was just became available, and it was either that or commuting, 40 miles to Helena for something else.
Right. Well, and it's linked to what you've studied.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense.
Right.
No, it is. It's so interesting because people are so passionate, the responses, on the website or just around town when you talk to people who go there, people are so passionate in response. Or when I was just in the office with you the other day and was listening to another woman talk about her experience and then you talking about one other person's experience, it's so passionate, that it was surprising to me.
Mm-hmm.
And interesting, and made it more interesting to me, and
right.
Curious.
Yeah.
And I love the sign. That was when we didn't move here, but when we came here, I just that's such a great sign. I mean, it's so huge on the mountain, the Mary Luda sign, and it's a big happy birthday sign on the mountain, but it says Mary Luda, which is such a contradiction of terms.
I know, it's funny.
Yeah.
Well, okay, I gotta tell you real quick the the story behind the Mary Widow, name, the Mary Widow, because, I don't know for sure, but this is, hearsay, because I need to do research. I want to find out, from the very beginning, the entire history of the mine, before it was a health mine,
And but it was called the Mary Widow when it was a golden silver.
As far as I know, yes, it's always been the Mary Widow.
Uh-huh.
But, a lot of times mines were called Widowmakers back in the day, but in this case, the story is that the mine was owned by a wealthy man who owned several other mines in the area. And I guess he wasn't a very nice person. So when he died, his wife inherited everything, all the money and the mines. And so she was the Mary Widow. But I don't know if that's true.
And she named it or
it got named after the original people, I'm not sure if it's even true.
Uh-huh.
I just kind of think
makes
it's sort
a
of a
story,
charming
though.
Story.
Yeah, it's colorful.
Yeah, the sound of Mary Widow is just sort of grim.
Yes.
I don't know. People are kind of that's creepy.
Exactly. And then linking it with the idea of health, mine also, but I mean, those are the, I just know it's beautiful, so it's literary or something, all of it. if it was called Health Mine, it would just be
it would just be so generic.
It would just be Health Mine. Otherwise, it's colorful.
Mm-hmm. Yep. There's not too many businesses with that name, I imagine.
Mm-hmm. So, your guys' space down the street, how often do you open that, or?
Usually just if there's, an event in town, to bring more people in. And I guess occasionally I've just sort of let random people go look through there, but right now we've moved all the rummage out because it's kind of a construction zone right now. So we're getting the power hooked up again. That building has a lot of history, too. It was an old mercantile, and back, around the turn of the century. And the upstairs was a brothel, also about that time.
This doesn't look like it had. Does it? How much upstairs is there?
It's really low ceilings, but the upstairs was separated into like little hotel rooms with that beadboard walls.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. It's really cool. We're gonna try and get that fixed up for a living space too, but right now it just sort of looks like an attic kind of, you know. But and then the basement, which isn't really a basement, it's kind of a little cellar, I guess, was a bootleg whiskey still during Prohibition. We found the still down there, and I didn't even know what it was. I was like, what is that, some sort of old pump or something, you know, like a water pump? And then this old-timer in town, Hap Bullock, told us he knew the guy that used to run the still when he was a kid, you know. He said his name was Old Joe, and he had that still down there. And we found some of the little, like, bottle tops from the old whiskey bottles. They like had little spouts on them. I didn't know what that stuff was. I guess that was the story. So pretty interesting. But yeah, that building was kind of a thrifty deal. I got that from the guy that I work for.
At the Health Mine?
Yep. Yeah, so
it has the big sign on the side of it.
Right, it used to be the mine office, actually in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
That was the last time it was used, and then it was basically boarded up and abandoned.
Wow.
So, and everybody was saying, oh, that old building needs to be torn down.
Oh.
Yeah, and I was like, no! Because it, you know, Basin used to have, I've seen old photographs of Basin where the whole streets were just lined with old wooden buildings, you know, just like that, with the false front and the cornices up on top. And, you know, they've all since either burned down or been torn down. And it's basically the last one standing. And I thought, well, you know, it's worth saving. And then the more we've done to it, the more we've realized it's worth saving. Like, you know, the walls are, you know, just like the, what do you call it? Basically, the sheeting, I guess you would call it, on the inside of the walls is 1x20s fir. Fir is the Montana hardwood, I guess you'd call it. But you can't even get wood like that anymore.
Wow.
You know, and you know all the you know hardware on the doors and everything is just really special and unique and historic, and you just can't find things like that anymore. So I'm glad we've been able to save it from its fate.
And so are you guys thinking of living in that space?
Eventually.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it just needs a lot done to it first. Like, the water and sewer was hooked up for a brief period in the 60s when it was the old mine office, but that needs to be all redone. Today we're getting the power hooked up, actually, so that's kind of an exciting landmark.
Oh, that's exciting. Congratulations.
We're going to get the record player hooked up. We've had all of our records stored over there, and we haven't heard any of them in so long, and we're just going to crank up some records.
I know Mark has been talking about the record player he saw.
That's the Victrola. Yeah, we have some 78s too for that. But no, we also have like a regular turntable for LPs. You know? So we're excited about that.
That's great.
Mm-hmm.
This is a big day. Yeah. And so in town, how is there sewer, or is it a septic system?
Actually, Basin has a really good system. It's, I guess they call it lagoons or sewage drainage lagoons. It's not a septic. Actually, all of the sewer water runs down to these settling ponds, they call it, which is, I guess, one of the most eco-friendly ways to deal with sewage, you know, because it basically breaks down, it decomposes naturally. So, I mean, it's, you know, I guess one of the least toxic ways to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just outside of town on that back frontage road a little ways. There's a couple of settling ponds over there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then they test it all the time to make sure it's not, like, you know, leaching out into the river or anything like that. So,
right.
Yeah. And I guess back in the 80s, Basin's water was just like pumped right out of Basin Creek. Yeah. Which is full of mine tailings.
Yeah.
Because of all the old mines. So I think that probably explains why some people that have been here a while are a little crazy. But now, of course, it's just well water. But yeah, that was even, you know, even in the 80s they did that.
Wow.
So But now that's just well, there's, I think, two different well pumps in the town. So, and the water's good, I think, in the town, so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we used to live outside of town, and we didn't have electricity or running water, so we had to haul our water, and we would just drive up to the spring.
Wow.
Up Sunnyside and fill up 5-gallon jugs with the spring water. Just came right out of the mountain. There was this little, somebody had pushed a little piece of PVC into there to get it to drain into an area, and we would just fill up 5-gallon jugs there and haul them up to the cabin. So
that's such a commitment.
Mm-hmm. It was, you know, but, you know, up until just the last few months, we didn't have electricity or running water the whole entire time we've lived here.
Wow.
So almost 8 years.
Wow.
And, you know, you just get used to it. It's really... I mean, that was, I guess, what I wanted to do when I lived in Minnesota. I wanted to move to Montana and do that, you know. And so, you know, I got used to it, and it really wasn't much of an issue. I would often, like, forget to even mention it, you know. Like, it just wasn't really an issue at all for us. So, but, you know, and that was fun. I can definitely appreciate running water, that's for sure. But, you know, we had systems for everything. We had a shower system, and which was kind of a homemade type of deal. But so, you know, we had it to where it was, you know, pretty livable, and you know, even my parents used the homemade shower that we made. So
that's great.
it was interesting. Hey, how's it going?
I'm gonna get you another chair. Just a second here. I'll get it, cause you come.
So, this is like live on the air, isn't it?
This is live on the internet.
Okay, I'm just gonna take this opportunity to say, if in the unlikely event John and Susanna are listening in Chicago, it was great having you guys here, and I hope you had a great rest of your trip. But if you're not hearing this, then never mind.
Is that
Ryan's fault? No. Our friends John and Susanna that came to the coffee shop the other day.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm. You've had a lot of visitors.
Yeah, just in the last couple of weeks. It's funny, everybody comes at once. And Pete's coming next week. It's all at once.
Oh, good. And Barry?
No, she's actually going to, like, this nursing school in West Virginia.
Oh, good for her.
Mm-hmm. Well, it'll be archived also. I'll give you the address so you can give it to your friends and they can listen to it.
Oh, really?
Not live.
Oh, okay.
So Jacques is a party-colored poodle, is that?
He's a party-colored poodle. He's 3.5 years old. He's 9.5 pounds. He's probably the most delightful dog in the world.
He really is.
He's a party boy.
He is. I keep thinking he's like a circus dog. Like, he's so perky and, like, springy.
But he knows no tricks.
Yeah, well.
Oh, well.
He's his own trick. But thank you, Briar, for coming.
Sure.
And it's fun to see you guys walking around last night.
It was nice.
Out tattooing each other with crayons. I got a Barbara hamburger.
Oh, you got a Barbara Weisberger hamburger.
Yes.
How lovely. Wonderful.
But Briar, I wanted to ask you about, well, you, in my understanding, is you also came to Basin from somewhere else. Is that?
That's right. I came from Basin, from Seattle.
From Seattle.
Where I had spent 30 years doing a myriad of jobs, but grew up in Montana, and for family reasons came back, thought I would stay here a year, and have now been here 5 years, and it seems to be where I'll stay.
And we're all glad.
I made a list that's like things I'll miss from Montana. Breakfast at Briar's, you know, like number one. So I bet people who live here are like, Bob, they're not going to let you go.
No, you will not leave.
I will not leave. Okay, me and Jackie, we live here now.
And so did you have experience like with a cafe or anything before coming?
I did. I owned a lesbian bar in Seattle called The Wild Rose. It was a bar and cafe, and it's still in existence. It's the oldest gay bar, I think, on the West Coast right now.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it's a great place. It's a great place. And I started that with five other women in 1985.
Oh, good for you.
And sold it in 95 and started a little coffee shop in Seattle called The Four Angels, which I kept for a couple of years. And then when I decided to move here, also got hit with breast cancer. A lot of things happened. And came to Montana and opened The High Note.
Wow. Well, in Seattle is the heart of coffee cafe, isn't it?
It's absolutely the heart of cafe. And in fact, the espresso machine that I have at The High Note is the one I bought for The Wild Rose in
1985. Oh, that's so cool. I take a picture of it.
When I tell everyone, we have the best coffee in Montana here, Jason. It really is.
It's good coffee, and that's a great old machine. And Liz, I don't know if you remember, but the first year I was here, I was carrying it around in the back of my car, and it froze solid.
Oh, no.
And I was worried, and then I just plugged it in, and it's just a wonderful old machine.
Mm-hmm.
So
they built things to last then.
They did. Yeah. Mind you, the problem you have over here is that there's nobody to work on. Mm-hmm. You can call Missoula or Bozeman and pay $300 for somebody to come out to change a gasket. So
oh, my goodness.
You're just really, I have to treat it so carefully to make it last.
You probably had to become a certain amount of a mechanic.
Yeah, but I'm not much of a mechanic.
Uh-huh.
I have two leaks right now that I just keep. At least I know where they're leaking from, what, why, or what to do about it. I have no idea yet, but it's just living in Montana.
Wow. I don't think that far down the line. Like, you know, like, yeah, of course that's a hard thing, but
right. You don't when you're from the city.
Yeah, exactly.
It's shocking.
Basically, all the things you take for granted.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, so. That's such an exciting history. I can't. I have all sorts of friends who are going to love to know about the first lesbian bar in Seattle's coffee maker being here.
It wasn't the first bar in Seattle, mind you. No, no, there were all those early bars that, you know, Seattle has a history of gay bars, but ours is now the longest running.
Oh, longest running.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, the whole culture has changed, and in the 70s, 60s and 70s, when I first came out, the bars, gay bars, were pretty much underground. You didn't know where they were. They were hidden.
Right.
We decided kind of to take it to a new step, and we had a very light, open place. We had a big kitchen, and we said, okay, we're going to have a bar that we'd be proud to invite our parents to. And did that kind of as a historical beginning to the whole movement.
That's such a big deal.
It was a big deal at that time. And then, of course, now there's hardly a need for gay bars as mainstream culture has kind of, in some ways, embraced the gay and lesbian culture. But
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Yeah. It seems like there's still such a, like in New York, there's still such a thriving, like, neighborhood scene. And,
mm-hmm.
and it feels very important, and it feels very, very alive and... It seems like any community
mm-hmm.
likes to have an area where it knows it's within its community.
Right. I think
when
so.
When there's artists or,
yeah,
you know, and then
exactly.
there's all sorts of cross
right.
crossing.
Right. Which brings us to Basin, because to me one of the interesting things about Basin is we really have kind of created some places where we bridge a cowboy mining conservative Western culture to the gay and lesbian culture that thrives here in Basin,
mm-hmm.
to the mines, to the
mm-hmm.
radon health mines,
mm-hmm.
to the young hippies who are really trying to live off the grid, trying to live simply.
Mm-hmm.
And for a small town, you know, it's not that we're all part of the same community. We are a lot of different communities,
mm-hmm.
but we really survive because all of us are here and collaborating and cooperating
right.
and trying to create something new,
right.
I think.
Yeah, I think that's one of the great things about Basin is although there are, you know, so many different sort of mini cultures in this one little area, everyone kind of accepts each other to an extent, you know. There's not a real big clash, you know. Everyone kind of knows that's that person's story and that's their deal. So, you know, it's not really an issue, you know, if you're different, because everybody's different here.
Right. Right.
You know.
It's the beauty of it. Mm-hmm. And then the artists, you know, which, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the Montana Artists Refuge, mm-hmm. is just vital for me, and I suspect, yeah. for you too, Liz, oh, yeah. because the town could be very boring. Mm-hmm. Because it is a small, mm-hmm. Montana town with a population of maybe 200 people.
Mm-hmm.
But every month, new artists come in from all over the country, all over the world, with different, you know, they're doing different things, whether it's performance art or radio or visual arts or music or poetry. It keeps us alive. It keeps, mm-hmm. the town alive, and yeah. it's really fun. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, it's so inspiring that people have created those things. Claudia was here and saying how, like, in Montana, it's like a very, like, you have to make what you want, you know, yeah. and that was sort of the spirit of this place, like, okay, we want these things, and so... And it's inspiring, again, in that way of, like, not having to think that way in the city, because so many of those things are already in place, like the barista repair person or
right.
whatever. You know?
Right, exactly.
Or
culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the Artist Refuge always is bringing new culture in.
Right.
And it's always changing. That's what's good about it. Otherwise, life would just get... way too mundane. Actually, I don't think we'd probably live here if it wasn't for this.
I don't think I would either, Liz.
I don't think if this aspect wasn't here, it just wouldn't have as much appeal. It adds, mm-hmm. so much. We are so glad you're here.
Well, we're glad you're here. We're so glad to be here. We're so glad you're here. It's mutual. It's not one-sided at all.
I would say there's two more things we're thinking about adding to Basin. If anybody out there is interested in investing, we want an IKEA and a Trader Joe's.
Are you serious?
Well, that'd be really helpful.
Trader Joe's, I can understand the IKEA.
The parking lot would take up the
exactly. It's like as big as the town.
But it would make Basin a destination spot.
Yes, it would, but for Swedish meatballs and, like, yeah, I guess, like, living in New York, I feel like IKEA, I always feel psychologically dirty after I've shopped there, because,
really?
Yeah, I do. It's like, I feel like I've just cleared out somebody else's rainforest to, like, have some piece of furniture that's going to last 5 years.
Okay, no IKEA, just Trader Joe's.
Yeah, that would be interesting if Basin was actually a destination. People always ask me, especially at the mine, like, what do you do here, you know? But then it's like, what do you do anywhere?
Exactly.
You have to just do your own thing, exactly. No matter where you live. So.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I get that question, too. Oh, you're only open 4 days a week. What do you do the other three? And I'm thinking...
I used to be only open three.
I know.
Four is really hard.
It's pushing me. It's really pushing me. What do you do the rest of the time?
It's like that.
It's funny, isn't it?
I guess I've been thinking these kinds of thoughts too, just like having a kid and like really not wanting to have television anymore. And I don't watch television. We didn't have a television for many, many, many years. And but so much of culture is geared towards, like, okay, so this, you go to work and then you watch television, or and like that's what you do, or then you go to a movie, or you go someplace and have dinner, and then you go home and watch television. And yeah, that what you do, like, we've been talking about, like, this rich, we've been talking about thrift shopping, mm-hmm. in Montana, and this rich, like, linens and, like, mm-hmm. handwork and stuff here, and Mark and I were talking about, like, well, okay, the winters are long, you know, and so it's a lot of time perhaps indoors, like indoor activities, and then just alternatives to watching television. Like, what did people do before you could watch television anyway?
Yeah, it's really sad that other people don't know what to do.
Yeah.
It's just such an odd question, I think. Mm-hmm. I hear it a lot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It came up for my father when he retired. Like, people are like, oh, what are you going to do now? You know, and like, he's like, hallelujah.
There's so much to do.
Exactly. I'm going to build my plane. I'm going to garden. I'm going to, you know, like, mm-hmm. And it's kind of sad to think about, yeah, what if you don't know what to do.
And the winters are long. And I personally think everybody here, it's good for us to get out for a couple of months, anytime. Just also to go to the cities and to go to other cultures and as much as you can. You know, it's cheap to live in Montana. So if you can, it's also hard to make a living in Montana. So
yeah.
It's a trade-off. But if you can get out, it then you have so much more to bring back.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you just learn. You learn to cross-country ski. You learn to hike. You learn to, you know, go out on these gorgeous, gorgeous winter hikes into country you can't go to at other times.
Mm-hmm.
You learn to see moose in their natural environment in the winter. And, you know, it's just, it's magnificent.
I think part of it is you just sort of mentally slow down. And you might know, you know, the feeling now that you've been here for a while after being, you know, in the city where life is just kind of more fast-paced because there's just so much activity, so much movement. But I think you just kind of sort of get the vibe of your environment, and when it's just the natural movement of nature, that just becomes, you know, a normal part of your life, and then you're not expecting all that stimuli all the time, stimulation, you know, and there is so much to do. There's, like, way too much to do. I don't even have time to do everything I want to do.
Right.
So, yeah, it's all about, you know, what you become accustomed to. And I moved here from Minneapolis, so it was an adjustment for me, too, you know.
So. Yeah, I've been so amazed at how waking and dreaming seem like so much less separate here for me. I think because I have less to process just in terms of crazy interactions on the subway or work or, you know, those sorts of things, and just been dreaming really vividly and sort of like three epic dreams a night, you know, whereas in the city, I think there's just so much to just process because I teach, or so you go home and you have to, like, process all of that and process your commute and process. Jackie,
Jackie had to get his word in
there. Exactly.
Jackie, come here.
Oh, Jackie,
come
here. Garden.
Good boy.
He's a good boy.
Erica, you've been here for a month. And this is only a month. That's as much as you're staying. How has it changed? Kind of. What are you thinking about as you go back? What will be different? Or got any thoughts on that?
I think so much of that, for me, I process things so slowly. So much of that, I think, will come to me after being back.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it's just such a huge gift for our family to be together in this way where, you know, there's all this outside time and together time, and we think about just what we want to eat and how we want to be together every day or not. And it's such a huge gift, and it reminds me that that's the those are the most important things, and like and I think somehow we always know that, but it's hard to remember that.
Right.
And but then just to be able to focus on my work here, I mean, I've been editing stuff and taking more pictures and like learning just more about myself. You know, it's like amazing because in the city, I teach, and so much of my time is thinking about helping other people, and so it's really unbelievable to be able to get to do this. And we had done a residency in Belgium in January, where Mark was in residence doing a printmaking project, and I was mostly chasing Dove around, and so we decided, so then I would apply to do this one, and it seems like a really nice way for us to work now with having a kid, soon to be two kids, because it's been a huge readjustment for us in our art making, because really he's the most important thing right now, and we know we'll always make our art, and so to not to not feel resentful, like, oh, I don't get to make art the same way. Well, I knew I wasn't going to. So, and this seems like a really, like, this has been, like, we're just learning. So,
yeah. And Dev's an artist.
Oh, yeah, well, of course. we all are. We're all born artists. And then,
lucky as you guys.
And then it gets beaten out of us.
I know. will you do other residencies? Your family, do you think?
Yeah, we're going to Newfoundland, not next summer, but the following summer. We were invited to residency there for the summer, which will be exciting because neither of us have ever been there. And I feel like next year with a new-ish baby, probably we won't. And then we'll be recovering financially from doing two big residencies this year. So next year is kind of at home. But yeah, and then we'd like to come back here, you know, but probably after.
After the baby's a
little
bit older.
Yeah, exactly, after a little while.
A lot of artists have done that. I mean, you know, come back after a period of time.
Yeah.
Well, some have moved here.
I know. Some never leave.
Yeah. Well, you can see the attraction. But Mark has been so, like, he's been reading this book, The Wobblies, since we've been here.
Great.
And he's been so inspired just by the history of the mining and labor. And he really wants to come back and do a project in relation to that. And so I'm sure. Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. We talked about trying to buy a place upstate so we could have some space, and now we're like, gosh, it's cheaper to buy something in Montana. You could just fly out, like the cost. Exactly. If we actually had all that money that we're fantasizing,
right?
But like, you could, you know, with an academic schedule, you could spend part of winter and part of the summers.
Right.
And it would cost less than buying something upstate New York.
Yeah, good point.
So it's in our blood now, for sure.
Well, and Montana's a changing place, and I know Liz has been looking for property for quite a few years. Did you talk about that at all?
No, I haven't.
Because it's really, it has changed even in the 5 years I've been here. Mm-hmm. The economy's changing, and it's a little bit frightening to me how quickly mostly land is getting so expensive. And so it means the locals will have more and more trouble buying, and we'll just see what happens. We have a great planning board in this county, and talking about subdivision regs and trying to take care of the land, trying to take care of the environment, because if we don't, Montana doesn't have much other than that.
Right.
And we've already destroyed it so badly by the mining. So here we are.
And logging up north.
Oh, and logging. Holy
cow. And they're
cow.
Talking about putting in the, you know, the big oil rig in the Rocky Mountain front.
I know. Oh, God, we have to fight that.
Oh, I know, we do.
You know, they could put windmills.
Really? Yeah, that's what they're doing in Wyoming and North Dakota.
The Rocky Mountain front is one of the most beautiful. Have you been up?
No.
Yeah, there's no other place like it on Earth. And it's a habitat for every species of wildlife that lives in Montana. And that, it made me cry one time. I was like reading through one of my Montana Wilderness Association books. And mm-hmm. It was like, I don't know, I probably had like PMS or something. I was like overly emotional. Mm-hmm. And there was just this picture of a mama moose and a baby moose. Mm. And I just like started bawling when I realized like their home could be completely destroyed.
Right.
And that is just, it's just so unfair. It's just, it's just an abhorrent thought that, you know, that we would just completely disregard that for a pittance of oil. I don't even know what they figured it is, but nothing, basically. It would just ruin it. It would ruin it. And so we need to be very careful to consider, you know, the impact on the, obviously, generations of humans, but also, you know, the animals that are, you know, part of what makes this state so great.
Mm-hmm. I went up there this last year for the first time to see the, there's about a 3-week period or less when the tundra swans and the snow geese are, they migrate through right by the front. And the sky just turns white, and these thousands. Wow. There were like 20,000 birds up there, and it was remarkable. I mean, it was, you do, you have tears streaming down your eyes, your face, because you're just, it's mind-boggling to see that and to know that happens every year. Mm-hmm. They come through, they're here for a week or 2 weeks at the most, and then they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just great.
Mm-hmm.
Love that about Montana.
Yeah.
Yeah, most states have been so altered that aspect of, you know, wildlife and wilderness isn't really even there anymore.
No, definitely not.
We still have it here, so we need to take care of it.
I know. Well, it just seems so urgent, and it seems like we're, I don't know, just as people, though, why don't we learn rather than, because everybody else did it doesn't mean that that's okay to now do it here too.
It seems like there is more of a movement nowadays, don't you agree, in Montana? It's turning from the more conservative side to, you know.
I do, Liz.
To protect this. It seems like more people are.
On the other hand, we have a president of the United States who still believes that global warming is a myth, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit of a problem. And who believes that we can solve the environmental issues and problems by new technology as opposed to...
Yeah.
Well, I think you'd have to be living in a cave to believe that. I think it's just propaganda. That
yeah.
The media, they're just saying it. He can't possibly believe that.
Yeah.
Or it's in his oil interests and economic interests and capitalist interests to believe it. And so he's not going to change because it's the truth.
Right.
Oh, well, we won't get too far into politics, but it's a bit of a problem.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. I mean, that's part of why I started doing this,
uh-huh.
because I think it's so exciting how everything, thrift shopping to everything, like, intersects into politics.
Yes,
and,
doesn't it?
You know, like, I just, in the forums for discussion, well, they aren't really forums for discussion, they're forums for being talked at, and to just learn about other people's experiences, like starting like this the first sort of out open light filled space in Seattle for women, and I don't know, I just like it's so like I just, the older I get, the more I realize like everything's so connected, like the moose's habitat to
a place that safe haven for women to go when it wasn't accepted.
Right.
Yeah, it's all the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Speaking of what you're doing here with this kind of radio show, you know, one of the other concern I have in Montana is what I've seen happen in other cities, and that is, for example, they're now talking about a Barnes & Noble in Helena.
Uh-huh.
You know, box stores, I know there's a class analysis about box stores and that working class people need cheaper places to buy things. On the other hand, especially records, books, movies,
the media, if we lose all of that, if that becomes just box store, if we lose Montana Books, which is a great little private bookstore in Helena, and we will, I think, if Barnes & Noble opens up, because already they can't keep the kind of stock they need to have, so we're always ordering books as opposed to being able to go in and buy books. Barnes & Noble, you know, will have them, and we'll lose that bookstore. Mm-hmm. They'll put in an Old Navy, and we'll lose the Soul Sisters. Now, you can't, or Base Camp, both of which are places where you know the buyers are actually looking at products. What's going to work in Montana? Yeah, it's a little bit more pricey, but damn, it's not a box store, and it's people's lives, and those people hire local people, and, you know.
And I think that's just a big old lie that working class people need whatever the box store is.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously millions of people believe that lie and shop there, but it is a lie because it's just not so. I mean, you can be, you know, extremely poor and still be able to get everything you need. And, you know, I actually am able to buy probably 90% organic food for our household. And, you know, there's people that make 2-3 times as much money as I do a year and say they can't afford it.
Right.
Well,
you're right.
Of course you can. It's just about sacrifices. Exactly. What are you going to choose for your life? You know, what is your priority?
Well, and it's about sort of that disposable lifestyle that you were mentioning earlier with the thrifting. And I just think Old Navy.
Doesn't that make you sick?
Yeah.
Well, look at New York. I mean, New York, it's mind-boggling. Every subway stop, you know, now what do you see? You see a Starbucks, you see a Barnes & Noble, you see a Gap.
I mean, it's not it's incomparable, but all I can think of is like ruining the Moose's habitat. Like, I feel like we've killed
neighborhoods.
We've totally killed neighborhoods in the city, and flavors and distinctions. And, you know, I feel like I work in the Mall of America at New York University. It's like right that bit of Broadway where it's like Barnes & Noble. It's everything. Kmart, everything. Right there, I feel like a step on the street and I feel slapped in the face by just crap. Right. And, you know, I, as well as many other people, came to New York in a similar spirit, I think, to people coming to Montana, where it's like there's this really rich culture, diversity. Like, it's like you want to be someplace where people are speaking all of these. Like, it's a place of contradictions, the way that I feel like Montana is, this place of extremes and contradictions, and that's why you come or are drawn there. And I feel like it's just turning into a homogenized glass of milk, the biggest glass of milk full of hormones.
Right. Bozeman's a really good example of that.
Isn't it?
Because the first summer I spent in Montana was 95, 11 years ago. It was a totally different place back then. It was kind of... it was still a college town then, of course, but it was really, like, quaint and old-timey. The perfect example of what's happened in Bozeman is this little greasy spoon that we used to go to called the Cowboy Cafe, that they had, like, these breakfast, like, eggs and potatoes for, like, $2.99 or something. It was, like, the best deal in town. Anyway, that place, you know, within, I don't know, it's probably been 5, 6, 7 years ago now, became Boodles, this, like... Have you seen that place in Bozeman?
Yeah.
It's all fancy schmancy. I mean, it's nice looking. You know, they always do a good job with that. But it's just the whole idea of that's what's happened in Bozeman.
Right.
The same building that was the Cowboy Cafe became this fancy, like, big crystal chandeliers, grand piano, you know, $30 plate meals, you know, totally different. And now, you know, the whole rural area surrounding Bozeman, which when I was first there was basically farmland, because the Gallatin Valley is the most fertile valley in Montana, is now all subdivisions. You know, cardboard, cookie cutter houses, one after the other. You know, and it's really sad, but, I mean, I still like Bozeman. It's just different from how it was. Even just, you know, in that period of time, in that short of time, it's become
a totally different place.
And is it a lot of the chains? Like, is the place a chain? Mm-hmm. Or is...
Well, for one thing, like North 19th Avenue, it used to start like off of Main Street and go out towards the freeway, and there was nothing on it. Then they put in a Costco at the end of it several years ago. But there used to be nothing. It was just like farms. And now it's like, it's, let me think how it goes. well, there's like a few, those little like mini malls. And then there's like a big Gap, Pier 1, Home Depot, Old Navy, Target.
PetSmart.
Yep. They're all, and then it's just solid all the way up to the freeway. I mean, and that's just been like in the last 5 years.
Right. Miles of it. Mm-hmm. Miles of it in Bozeman.
Yeah. It's just popped up.
We don't need that. We just don't need that.
No, exactly. Nobody needs as much stuff as culturally we're trained to feel like we need right now.
Right.
And it's really hard. Like, I even know that, and I struggle with, I mean, I really look to what you, like, choosing to come to Montana to, like, give up electricity and running water.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I look to that with so much respect. You know, and I try to be simple within the city, but it's like the culture, like it's so huge.
Nice.
And I walk home, I walk, after I teach, I walk down Broadway to the train, because after being indoors for however many hours, like I like to take this longer walk, and I was teaching nights, and so I would walk down past Old Navy in Soho, and they would be unloading the trucks into the stores, and it was like three nights a week. And they have this whole system, this roller system that goes into the store from the truck. And then there's like all these people, and it's just like box after box after box after box after box, like being rolled into this store. And it's so amazing. I mean, I know there are a lot of people in New York City, but I also know that there are many Old Navies in New York City, and it just seems so gross in all of its definitions.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so big.
And it's not about,
so,
it's not about need either.
No, it's like,
because, actually, sorry, there was this Home Depot commercial that we saw on TV, like, I don't know, maybe a couple of months ago or something. And, like, it was this guy, like, backing out of his driveway, and he, like, accidentally ran over all these tools. Did you see that one?
I did.
And then he was, like, glad. He was like, oh, good, now I get to go buy new tools at Home Depot. And it was, like, seeing. He obviously didn't need the tools. He just wanted new ones. It was just... That is just the whole thing. That's the whole reason we all find really nice stuff at
thrift
store.
Yeah, it is.
But it's interesting, though, when did that shift start to happen? Like, at least in the U.S., when did that... Was it in the 70s? Was it...
Well, I've been thinking about that.
Uh-huh.
It's a little off the topic, but I think it's connected.
Uh-huh.
Because I believe that we... have become such a fear-based culture. And having... I watched Capote recently, and I remember in the 60s when I read In Cold Blood for the first time. And I also grew up in rural Montana, where, especially in the 40s and 50s, there were so many people, hobos especially, coming through on the trains. And my family would always feed them. It was part of the deal, was out the back door you had soup and stuff. And when I had the bar in Seattle, always on Mondays, that was my thing, was to feed the bums. But I think whether it was Capote and In Cold Blood or when it happened, we became a very fear-based culture. And all of a sudden we, instead of... And I don't know if this is a myth, if it's a rural myth, but it was true where I grew up. You did share. You know, my father said you can't be a good Catholic without being a socialist. You have to share with people. You can't hoard what you've got to protect just your family. You have to look at life as a community, and society as a community. And then we got scared, and we got so scared we started hoarding. And then we got so scared that somebody's going to come into our homes and kill us, so we started locking all of our doors. And then you get so scared you just don't even want to talk to strangers in the street. And I think that's part of consumer culture, because fear means hoarding, means I want, means this is mine, and then it becomes I have to have more and better and mm-hmm. best, and you know, we've created a culture, not just fear-based and consumer-based, but that's really unconscious. We've mm-hmm. become quite unconscious about who we're trying to be in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what we're trying to do here. Whether how well we do it, we've got all those other influences, but let's stay conscious. How are we trying to live our lives in relation to environment, in relation to community, in relation to product? It might be too late. I don't know. But at least we're trying.
I don't think it's too late.
You don't think it's too late?
As long as we're still breathing.
Yeah. I don't know, that fear thing. Fear is an interesting,
mm-hmm.
it's an interesting thing to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it keeps coming up, you know, in relation to politics, in relation to just, I mean, it seems like it's been, yeah, it keeps coming up.
George W. Bush is scared, you know, he's so scared, I guess. He's greedy and scared.
And interested in being scary. Like, that's the thing about being scared. It's like you want to scare other people more
exactly.
or something.
Yeah, exactly. We have to be bigger. We have to be better. We have to be the global police. I don't want to be the global police.
No.
I don't want to be the police at all.
I want to be some police, you know? Yeah. Well, Briar, so I wanted to ask you, it's only like this is a shift, but I mean, about cooking here. It seems so silly, like, to then be like, so, high altitude baking.
Well, Liz knows this because she's also a baker, but, okay, switch gears. We could go to high altitude baking. You have to do about 10 degrees higher than you do at sea level. What I would bake in Seattle, I would have baked at 350. Now I bake at 360. So that's my level. Martha Stewart thing. But let me tell you about really baking in Basin and in a small town, which is really different than running the two joints I had in Seattle, which were... You know, I think I've told you, Liz, I was doing 300 to 400 cups of coffee a day you know, it was whole different thing. Boom, boom, boom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mind you, I was always trying to do a quality job, but nonetheless, quality suffers when you do that kind of quantity, just because your machines get worn out and you know, whatever. What I love about Basin, I don't always do it, but when I can, you know, you can just make things so pretty. Every mm-hmm. plate is kind of individual. Every mm-hmm. plate is a treat, a delight to kind of put together, and you get to look at colors and textures and, oh, gee, the pineapple looked great today, so I can put a little pineapple on or a fresh peach or not because there weren't any and it was too pricey. And
mm-hmm.
I think my customers know that. And right. but and it's a joy. It's mm-hmm. such a treat, you know. Remember when I had those crab cakes because I got a good deal on fresh crab? I mean, that was just, it's so much fun.
It's to be flexible.
To be flexible mm-hmm. and to make everything pretty. And
mm-hmm.
and that's an aesthetic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I love that. Unfortunately, it's really hard to make a living.
Yeah, I bet.
You know? But...
Even with all the lattes I bought?
I know. I know. You're wonderful.
No, I bet. And I bet the weather just, yeah, so many things affect how many people are coming in or not. Or
and it's the difference, you know, 10 people to 20 people really makes a huge difference.
No, I'm sure, yeah.
Or the price of milk, you know, for example.
Yeah.
If because, again, it's a small quantity, if milk is on sale for 2 gallons for $4, it's like, oh, cool, you know, you'll make some money this week. You have to drive to Helena and get it.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not and it's over $4 a gallon, you know, you just know it's going to be a little bit rougher this weekend, especially if nobody comes in.
Yeah.
So it's...
You know, you could actually consider fluctuating your prices based on, you know, market value or
Like the catch of the day plate
kind
of
thing.
Exactly.
You could.
True.
Because
yeah.
really your prices are...
low compared to everywhere else.
Yeah, but I'd like that.
Well, I do too. And, you know, this is basic, but still, you know, people would understand if you, you know, raise things, you know, a little
here
bit.
And there, yeah.
Here and there, yeah.
Although I did this last year, you know, and that was... That was hard for me to do. It was a smart thing to do.
Mm-hmm. To raise the prices or to do a market?
To raise the prices. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. We had. I do. The first year I was just nuts.
Mm-hmm. But yeah. Really
remember
that?
Yeah. Hey, you want a double tall latte for $1.50?
It costs. Sure. It costs. My fryer.
Organic.
Yeah. But hey, I got everybody addicted, see?
Yes, exactly.
It worked.
Your ploy worked.
We saw your sausage guy. We went to the Butte farmer's market.
Oh, you did.
And I said, hey, we've been eating your sausages at the High Note in Basin. He's like, Briar, she's been so good to me. Like, she's been with me since I started.
Well, he's a good story. This is a Montana story. So there I am heading out to Elkhorn Hot Springs, which is about 200 miles from here, and it's one of my favorite hot springs, and I go up there and spend a night, you know, 3 or 4 times a year. Beautiful drive. And I'm driving through this gorgeous valley outside of Dillon, and I see this sign, Top of the Hill Sausage, way out in the country. What the hell's that? So one of those days where you don't have anything else to do, I'll drive up. And I drive up, and here's a state-of-the-art, stainless, beautiful warehouse, butcher shop, whatever. And I meet this guy named Ron. And I toured his business, and he had worked for his whole life at a Safeway, being a butcher, and had retired and bought this land and decided, by God, I'm gonna do my own. What do you call a meat shop? Meat shop. Mm-hmm. And mostly he does live game for people. You know, they shoot their deer or elk, and he brings it in. But he started this sideline of really good top of the hill sausages and bacons, and so we ended up talking for a long time. And I thought, well, hell, they're pricey, but it's unique, and maybe that would work in Basin, and it's been fun to do. It's been fun to have that relationship with him, and to know you're supporting another business, local business.
Yeah, definitely, and especially with something like sausage, which is like sort of like has such a bad rep.
I know.
It's nice to know, like Mark grew up in a kosher family, and you know, like he's kind of like sausage, but. But like a handcrafted sausage,
it's like, isn't that nice?
Very appreciated, appreciated, yeah. Uh-huh. And I know he's been a huge fan of that.
I know.
And it's kosher. A lot of it, you know, comes from, you know, a loving person giving his. Energy into it instead of a factory farm or whatever.
I know, I really like him. And then, of course, through him, I've met his family, which are all an old Butte family, so I end up hanging out with them sometimes over in Butte. It's a trip. I know, I love it.
Butte has got to be, like, one of the most amazing places I've been to. And somehow it's, like, Both Mark and I, it's like really gotten under our skin in a way. It's like we really like it there, and like there's some really intense attraction, and also, I mean, I guess part of it is repulsion too. But like it's that, like it seems like such a complicated place and such a rich, rich place.
Right.
Not economically, obviously,
right.
But
culturally and
yeah,
historically.
And yeah. And architecturally,
yeah.
And just visually. And it's a crazy place.
Can I tell you a quick Butte story?
Yeah, please.
Because this was also connected to the Montana Artist Refuge, but there was an artist named Christy Hager who lived in Butte for a long time and did a wonderful painting of the Berkeley Pit, which is the big copper pit, the richest hill on earth, the pit that kind of closed down Butte, ate Butte, the pit that ate Butte, they call it.
Yeah.
But then about, I think it was 6 years ago, when the snow geese landed on the Berkeley Pit, the water that was in the Berkeley Pit, and they died.
Whoa.
Because it was so polluted.
Whoa.
And Christy was living in Butte at that time, and what she did was this project, which was really exciting. She went around all over the state of Montana and talked to women, and she got about 200 women together and practiced. She's also a hula dancer, and she created the Blue Water Hulas, Clear Water Hulas, and Judy Fiel, who is a local folk singer, did the music for this, and they did a performance piece on the edge of the Berkeley Pit, all of them dressed in blue, 200 women doing a hula dance to Cool Clear Water.
Yeah.
That is so moving and so exciting. Yeah, isn't it great? Mm-hmm. And she did a video of that now too, which is out, but it was a great performance piece, and it was a great movement.
Yeah. And well, I have to add something to that because I just read two books by Masaru Emoto, and I really feel like that probably made a huge difference.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I don't know that it's improved substantially yet, but, you know, the more people that, you know, make conscious effort to, you know, at least want cleaner water.
Right.
You know, that's all going to help.
Yep.
Are you familiar with the Masaru Emoto, who wrote the True Power of Water and the Hidden Messages in Water?
Okay, will you spell it?
Masaru?
That sounds right.
Then Emoto, the last name, you'd be able to find it. And he wrote, on the end. Emoto.
Emoto.
Okay. Yeah. And he wrote The Hidden Messages in Water and The True Power of Water. I think there might be another one too. Those are the only ones I have. But it basically deals with, he has an honorary doctorate in, what is it? Research. I don't know.
Water.
He's done all this work with photographing water crystals at the point of freezing, and by putting positive energy into the water, it actually forms beautiful crystals, as opposed to polluted water or water exposed to negative energy. I mean, that just, it totally makes sense. I think you'd really like it, actually, because it really ties in with everything, and to me, it just completely made sense.
I know, me too, but it's amazing, isn't it?
You know, yeah, it's like astonishing. Work
he on a
had.
Molecular
see,
level.
Yep, you could see all these photographs. The same water that was exposed to, you know, positive words like love and gratitude forms beautiful crystals, whereas, you know, when it's been exposed to pollution or negative words like you fool or, you know, just mean things, it will not form beautiful crystals. It's kind of misshapen blobs, and it's the same water. So, very astonishing work, and, you know, I think that could really do a lot to heal our polluted water,
mm-hmm,
wherever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what's the name of the artist that you...
Christy Hager, Hager. She's in Missoula now, and she's just absolutely wonderful. And that video, I believe, was supposed to be shown on PBS, but I don't know when. I can give you her number. It's just a great piece, Erica.
It sounds great. It sounds really moving.
Claudia was in that. You know, just a little bit. The other thing that women did, remember when after Bush invaded and all over the world women got naked and did those peace signs? You saw those that were,
yeah,
you know.
I didn't hear about
this
that.
Is great. I have this little calendar at my house. I'll try to find it.
And
because
you would have had an opportunity to lay down there and
know what you meant. And I did that here in Montana, and that was Katie Knight, a photographer in Helena, who kind of put that together. But it's moving, because here are probably 50 women writing peace with their naked bodies in the snow in Montana.
Yeah.
And support of that international movement.
Mm-hmm. And this is pre-Iraq or right?
It was right after the invasion, yes. And there was one in Japan and China and France and Italy and, mm-hmm, you know, Alaska and South America, and I don't know about Cuba, because they're smarter than us. But I mean, not smarter in terms of being involved in the peace movement, but they don't invade. Anyway, that was fun.
Yeah. So that was such a an intense period, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think of, I have actually, I'll burn for you the CD of this poet. I think one of the most amazing cultural events I've been to was, it was in a snowstorm, like a blizzard in New York, and I was about as pregnant as I am now, and there was this group of poets, and I can't remember the poet that had been invited by Laura Bush to the White House and then was disinvited because
right.
he was soliciting
right.
poems from artists all over the U.S.
for right.
sort of anti-war.
Right.
So he was uninvited, and the Not In Our Name organization then asked those poets to all come to Lincoln Center and read. And Mark's like, we're going. I was like, it's a blizzard, and I'm pregnant.
And we're going.
Actually, like, you couldn't even get a bus, you know? And so we're, like, schlepping to the subway, and we got there, and I'm so glad we went. It was the most amazing cultural event that I mean, it sounds very moving, like, in the way this woman's performance.
Uh-huh.
Like, it was so, the energy of the moment was so intense, but I have the CD, and I'll make a copy of them for you.
They're they're
just such amazing poems about, like, being present and
uh-huh.
being, upset and
mm-hmm.
many things, but,
That's one thing that's, one good thing that's come out of all this, the war and 9/11, has really brought a lot more consciousness right out onto the table, you know.
Yeah.
People have, like, a cause, I guess, a reason to, you know, unite for peace and, you know, make sure their point is heard. I was actually randomly at a peace rally in San Francisco right after 9/11. And it was really intense, you know. It was, you know, before we invaded Iraq, obviously. And, but it was like, you know, everybody knew. It was like inevitable
mm-hmm.
what was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so people were, you know, getting right on it. You
mm-hmm.
know, not wasting any time. And I remember I drove my VW out there, my bus, and I had found this, like, poster somewhere right after 9/11 that just had a picture of, like, the globe on it and, for, you know, from outer space. And I said, one planet, indivisible, and I put it up on the back of my van because I just felt like that was such an intense time where everyone was driving around with American flags
mm-hmm.
on their cars, and for the first time in my life, that symbolized something totally different to me.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't,
yes.
it wasn't like, you know, our country to the, like, childhood fantasies about what America is. It was, the American flag became a different symbol at
yeah.
that point in time to me. And maybe it's changed a little bit now more. And, you know, but, you know, at that point I felt like people were, I mean, obviously we were very shaken, but, you know, it seemed like when people displayed the flag, it was, to me, it looked like a pro-war sign. And that was why I put up the poster on the back of my van that just said One Planet, Indivisible. And I got so many mixed reactions driving my bus across the country, you know. A lot of people would pass me. People always pass me in my bus because I have to go so slow. People would pass, and some people would be peace signing out the windows when they saw it, you know. And then other people would just, like, you know, honk and then swerve over in front of me real fast, you know, like they thought I was being unpatriotic, but it was like, you know, we need to look at the bigger picture here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't want to get into this, but then of course, inevitably, we did get into this, but anyway,
mm-hmm.
like I was saying, it's at least been a good unifier for a lot of people, you know, this whole war thing. Some positive things have...
For sure. Although I, of course, grew up in the streets when we were protesting Vietnam.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, I felt the same thing then in the late 60s and early 70s. Wow, this movement can't be stopped. Look at us. You know, it was
mm-hmm.
so exciting.
Mm-hmm.
It was so exciting. And really, it's like we're starting over. I mean,
yeah.
It has to start over. And, you know, maybe we have a better consciousness now, and, you know, maybe it's a little bit more desperate now. I'm not sure. But that historical context makes me maybe not quite as optimistic as you. Because I used to be much more optimistic. Now I think, human nature is an interesting thing. Evolution is an interesting thing. And I really don't know which way it will go.
I understand. I do. And I guess I have fears when it comes to that. But, just the whole, I don't know. What am I trying to say? I guess I feel like, there's still a lot of people that are probably more aware, more conscious. There's been more revolutionizing things that have happened since that time.
Sure.
But at the same time, probably a majority of people have just gotten lazier. So that's what's scary.
Or economically more either dependent on consumerism.
Stuff.
And also so far in debt that they work all the time. Yes. And so movements become less important when you're, it's no surprise that movements, especially anti-war movements, are often young and students because it's a luxury. Unfortunately, it's still considered a luxury instead of, and maybe at a time in this country which is not too far away, it won't be a luxury. In fact, it will be the only way to survive.
Yeah,
is to stop what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder also though. I feel like the anti-war movement during the Vietnam era, like it had an impact, and I feel like those. I mean, we go to all the rallies in New York as well, and march to Washington, D.C. even. Mm-hmm. And, but I feel like they're so easily ignored by the media. Like, you go to something where there are tens of thousands of people, and it isn't even covered.
I know, it's shocking.
It's the powers that be that have also learned from the power that you guys garnered.
And
I feel like we need some injections of creativity now in terms of how are we going to reclaim some sense of power on the individual level.
And that's what you're doing here, Erica.
Yeah, I hope. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but it's like the only thing I can do, So, besides going to rallies and those sorts of things, but it's very important to go and to feel that connection with people, and like it feels very important in the moment, but then to have it completely ignored is shocking. And it's like you feel like you're five and it's like that's not fair.
I was at the WTO demonstration in Seattle about 6 years ago, was it? And I don't know if you remember that, but that started out. It was a week long demonstration. I had flown in for it because I just thought I'm going home to be with my pals on the street. And there was all. I just remember this so well because all the churches the first night did this big encirclement of the hole where the WTO was going to be held. And everybody was praying, and it was candlelit ceremony. And I think every church in Seattle was involved. It was beautiful. Mm-hmm. And then the next day were all the environmentalists, and I was one of the sea turtles, and we had these costumes on. We were all, there were hundreds of us in the streets. Yeah. And so this was the environmental day, and just tons and tons of people. And then the third day was a great big demonstration. Mm-hmm. And the whole city was pretty much closed down. And there was a huge line holding hands all the way around. And then downtown, there were marches coming from the South End, and there were marches coming from the University District, and there were, every culture was involved. There was all the labor movement coming up from the Seattle Center. There were jugglers and street bands, and it was the biggest fair-like thing. Mm-hmm. It was just gorgeous, gorgeous day. We were all so happy. Now, this is 5 years ago, and when I expected it in Vietnam, all of a sudden, Paul Schell, who was mayor of Seattle at that time, and who knows who he was talking to in terms of the federal government, it went crazy. And there were all of a sudden cops on the street and guns and tear gas everywhere. Mm-hmm. Little kids, it was sort of exciting in the sense that I hadn't seen the government come down on us because we haven't been doing anything. The government needed to come down on us in that way since 73, 74 at the latest. To see that happen so quick, to see a change both in the government's approach, but also a change in what happened in the streets, because once that happened, the fun disappeared, and the anarchists, who I have a huge respect for anarchists, don't get me wrong, but all of a sudden they were there throwing rocks, breaking windows, and the whole thing, it was like it turned from day to night in 2 hours, from a circus delight, music, art, cultural joy, to this tear gas and darkness and windows breaking and police everywhere. And it was so quick, so quick. I don't know what that means, but it happened, and it happened.
Yeah. My friend Mariva was at that, and she came to visit right after she got back. And, like, I could just, like, almost, like, see the energy from it. Like, she was just so, like, fired up from just the whole thing. And I could just feel it, like, bouncing off her. You know, so, you know, those things do carry over, though. And I also wanted to mention, you know, about, you know, Vietnam and that protesting. You know, a lot of people feel like, oh, maybe nothing really ever came to fruition. But I would say that Vietnam was... And, I mean, the protesting and the whole hippie movement was actually, even though I wasn't quite born yet then, it was a huge influence on my life, just knowing about it historically.
Sure.
You know, as a kid, I really admired the protesters, and I think that's helped shape who I am and also, you know, other people of my generation. So it definitely had an effect, maybe not exactly... you know, the effect that everyone was going for, like, stop the war, but it helped carry over the whole energy to future generations.
Right, that's good, that's good. You know what, Eric, I have to be back at my house at 2.
Okay.
Okay, so... Oh, got to go.
You're 2 minutes late.
I have 2 minutes late.
It should only take 2 minutes
to get home. I know. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you. You bet. I'll see you soon.
Yes, we'll see you. We'll see you Thursday before we pull out of town.
Come on, little boy. Wow, have we been doing this an hour and a half?
Yeah.
Wow. How long do you usually do it?
2 hours. Yeah, usually 2 hours, 12 to 2. I find longer than that, I'm delirious. Much longer than that.
Right.
But, I mean, it helps when there are other people with ideas and, you know, that sense of everything being connected. Really, I think it's so fundamental, and then also just gathering the people to make the connections. Yeah.
That's right. Sort of like a New Dimensions radio show. Only Jason's version.
Yeah.
New Dimensions. I don't know if you ever listen to that.
No.
NPR, Michael Toms.
I have a love, mostly love relationship. Sometimes hate relationship with NPR, but I think radio is such a cool thing. Like, I came to radio from photography, which, like, they're so different, you know, one's purely visual and one's purely sound, and but anyhow, I feel like there's so much more research for me to do and learning about radio and
Yeah, it's totally amazing, actually. I don't even understand the concept of... I mean, I guess I sort of understand the concept, but I don't really understand how it works. Radio, I mean, like... Well, obviously,
radio.
Satellite's different, I guess, because it's just going to a satellite.
Right.
But, like, traditional radio...
Radio waves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
From tower to tower. How did anybody ever figure that out? It baffles me.
So, Liz, may I come see your upstairs space in your building?
Absolutely.
Some time today, maybe.
Yeah.
We're actually leaving on Thursday. So
oh,
this
my
is,
goodness.
I know.
That's so soon.
I know. It is.
It's gone fast.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I have time. Actually, I have the next couple of days off, so Anytime.
Okay, well, maybe I'll walk down there with you now. Maybe I'll close this. And wow.
What?
27 listeners.
No way.
Yeah. So I'm going to put this back on this record. I was just explaining this. All of these things came from thrift stores. And
oh, something. That is so groovy. I love those old Fisher-Price things.
Part of what I've been doing here is been trying to learn how to yodel, but really it's turned into more just... But here... This requires finessing to get it to work.
Sometimes they prefer a nickel.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Because the quarter is so much times too much weight.
See, it's just jumping.
Okay,
yeah, absolutely. Do you know where it is? Okay.
Yeah,
okay. So I just want to thank both Briar and Liz for today. And say goodbye.
I'm gonna go to the hospital.